Good morning, everybody. My name's Sandy Beach, and I'm an alcoholic. How y'all doing? I want to thank the committee for inviting me, and I agree with all the other speakers that have been saying what a great collection of speakers we've had this weekend, and it really helps see the program more clearly. And my favorite, Clancy, he doesn't know this, but way back in the beginning when I was brand new, when I heard him, and I paid very close attention, he established in my mind the framework of what the problem is, what the solution is, all the variations, and that became like the bedrock that I used in my own thinking about the program. And it's always given me a realization that whatever I'm thinking about this year is solid, that it's based on this framework. And it's held me in good stead, and I don't think I've ever told you that, Clancy, but that is a gives me a great feeling of solidarity. And it's same thing when we see old-timers that have been around passing this message for a long time. It gives us a grounding that we realize this is something that is very powerful and that it really works, because when we're new and you look at spirituality, it doesn't look like it works. You know what I mean? It just doesn't look like it works. I can still have that feeling when my sponsor's telling me the steps, everything's in here. And I remember looking for the money step. Because I knew that was the most important thing that I needed with my six kids, and I owed everybody, and where was money? Money was clearly the answer. I mean, it was so obvious. Anybody could see that. And you're handing me this stuff, and so just do these steps. It'll all work out. How could it? And then I got to thinking about drinking. What if you didn't believe those other guys when they told you if you drank this big glass of whiskey, it would teach you how to dance? What if you said, that's ridiculous? No, I'm afraid to dance. I can't ask that girl to dance. And you're telling me that if I pour this in, I'll know how to dance? Now, doesn't that sound ridiculous? What if you just never drank it? To this day, as you went to your deathbed, you'd be going, I remember those guys were trying to fool me with that whiskey. And they were telling me that if I drank it, I'd know how to dance. Now, isn't that ridiculous? So wasn't that amazing that we poured it down, and guess what? Guess who was on the dance floor about 30 minutes later? And we suddenly realized that we had access to something that, who cares if we don't understand it? We know it works. And I think the program is very similar to that. Who cares if we don't understand it? We just know that it works. And none of this becomes visible until you do it. And those are important things to understand if you're new. I was thinking about, it's New Year's. Everybody makes resolutions. I don't know, I made one maybe, but I used to make tons of them. And I would come up with stuff like, well, I'm going to lose weight. I'm going to work out more. I'm going to save more money. I'm going to be more frugal and save up, and then I'll be able to buy that big car that I want. And I would share these things with my sponsor, and then he'd say, well, those are great, and you ought to really try for those, but, gee, why don't you try some spiritual resolutions? So I'd go home, and I'd go, spiritual resolutions? Well, I better think up something. You know what I mean? So if you're new, I want you to be thinking up some spiritual resolutions. And in case your sponsors ask you to think up some spiritual resolutions, and you might come up with something like this. Well, I resolve to be more loving and understanding with my wife and my children. And I resolve to be more patient and tolerant with all the people that I meet. And I resolve to pray more. and I resolve to be more generous in my giving. And then we run them by and said, how's that? Is the exact opposite of spirituality, those resolutions. They're not spiritual at all. They're not even close. And we sit there mystified because, after all, that sounds pretty spiritual, doesn't it? So then we go, why aren't those spiritual? Because you have laid out something that you're going to do on your own. You are going to be more generous. You are going to be more understanding. You are going to do all this. A spiritual resolution would say, I'm going to ask God to make me more generous. I'm going to ask God to help me be more understanding. In other words, we never do anything spiritual alone. It's a God help program and not a self-help program. So anytime we're going, well, I'm going to, and I've got my mind set on this, that's great, that's a self-help program, and that can get us so far, just so far. But so the question that always comes into my mind is, why do we constantly want to leave God out? You know what I mean? I do. I do it all the time. I go, yeah, it's great having God's help, but... You know what I mean? I like accomplishing things on my own. Myself, I don't know about you, but I kind of like to just get into it and accomplish things on my own. And I suppose that's the mystery of our program, is that knowing that things will really be quite simple and quite easy if we involve God all the time, why don't we do it? And so I don't know the answer to that, but maybe some of it will come out. I certainly didn't start out with any interest whatsoever in spirituality. Maybe some of you did, but that was not anything I was remotely interested in as a young man. And I think back on being young, and you know, you come into the world, and you see things and you hear things, and you realize you don't have a clue. You know that it's a big mystery, but you're sort of carrying on. Well, you know, I better study this and I better do that, but it's still a big mystery. And I look back on my life and I realize that when I was very young, they told me it was a mystery and they told me the answer to it. It was almost like they gave me a little box and they said, now listen, life is very complicated. It's very difficult to understand. But in this box is the answer to the mystery of life. And it has a padlock on it. And the combination to that lock is 6 left, 12 right, and 4 left. Good luck. Now, the first thing that most of us did was we said, being smarter than other people, you don't think they'd give us the right combination, do you? That's too freaking obvious, man. So I'm not going to even try that combination because I know it doesn't work. And I'm going to figure this stuff out on my own. And then we go on and on and on, and we're probably about 60 years old, and we stumble on 2 right, 12 left, 6 left, or 6 right, and the damn thing opens, and we go, God, that thing was right all along. They gave me the answer to start with, and then I went out and beat my head trying to figure out what everything was all about. Now, nobody gave me a lock, and nobody gave me any of that stuff, but I do remember going to church and having somebody tell me, God is the answer to everything. And I went, yeah, that's very interesting. I'm going to figure out something better than that, because that's obviously not going to cut it. And I remember I was brought up in the Catholic Church, and we had the little catechisms, and you had to study those things, and the nuns, and they're whacking on the head with the ruler, and everything was scary, and boy, I'll tell you, I felt like I was just a nervous wreck. My sister's next to me, she thought it was very friendly and fun. It's all in the eye of the beholder, but I found it a very terrifying thing, and I remember There was a question that said, where is God? And I said to myself, now that is an important thing to know. You know, I'm going to pay attention to this answer. And I'm sure all the Catholics here know the answer. God is everywhere. Now that's really helpful, isn't it? Everywhere. So you look and you look and you look and you conclude that that answer is wrong. Right? I mean, that's what I concluded. Everywhere. Everywhere. And what they left out was that you have to be plugged in to this spiritual power in order to see that that is true. And until that happens, you'll never be able to see it. And I think that's what happened, number one, the first time it happened, was when I drank. And I was plugged in to something that enabled me to see the beauty of the world and people, and to, while I didn't say it, I sensed that I was seeing this magical, loving world that these religious people were talking about. And then I got glimpses of it as I worked my way through the steps. And I would just do another one of these stupid things that makes no sense whatsoever. And then by some coincidence, I would get glimpses at the magnificence of other people. And I would see some truth in them. And then I would look around and I would see a lot of harmony in the world where all I saw before was friction. And I began to understand the power of the steps. But I certainly, as I was starting out, didn't have that. I found when I was 9 or 10, I had my own spiritual awakening in the church. I was sitting on the front pew and I was staring at the crucifix and it was big. In this church, it was 20 feet by 30 feet, wooden cross hanging from the ceiling, and you could not miss it. And I'm staring at it and staring at it, and it was almost like the crucifix saw me staring at it and said, little boy, do you know what this is? And I said, yeah. Do you know what the meaning of it is? And I said, no. These are little voices going on with me. Well, we're going to tell you. This is what God did to his only son that he loved. Guess what he's going to do to you? Boom. And it was my own personal awareness. No one in the rest of the world knew this secret that I had just learned. And it caused me to faint and fall off the pew and get carried out of the church, and I blamed it on bad food. Oh, I had something for breakfast. And my sister, what happened to you? What happened to you? I figured she wouldn't understand, so I kept it to myself that I had finally understood what all this was about. And they were right. You never want to die because it's going to be very bad. So I just, that was my little secret God that I carried around with me. So anytime anyone suggested that God might be my refuge, I knew better. So that sort of pushed me out on my own, living life. I grew up in Connecticut. I went to good little schools. I had polio as a kid when I was about 11. And we went to a place in Newington, Connecticut, for crippled children, and it was a big epidemic, and it frightened everybody because they didn't know what to do. And I lost use of my right arm and right leg. But I was one of the few that Sister Kenny treatment worked on, and after about 8 months, I got most of the use back and was able to go back to school and do athletics and all those kind of things. But it gave me a feeling that you couldn't trust the world, because one second I'm sitting at home and I'm feeling a little sick, and then the family doctor, back when the doctors came to your house, the doctor came and he went, and then he had a secret conference with my parents, and then I'm in isolation and nobody could come in and tell us what was going on. So I had this, number one, I never trusted doctors again. And I just lost trust in my parents or anybody else, because it just seemed to happen without any explanation. And then you couldn't see anybody for a couple months. So it was, what was going on? So help my conspiracy theory, you know what I mean? That, boy, life is dangerous. There's bad things going on all the time that you don't know about. And enjoy it. Be as happy as you can, but this is what the deal is. So anyway, I got through school and through prep school. It was one of those places that just automatically you went right into Yale, which was just down the street. And I got there, and all these people were much smarter, more handsome. They were just everybody. They all knew what was going on. They were rich. They had lots of money. And I was just a towny guy who happened to work his way in there. That was a feeling I always had about myself, you know, that as soon as I joined a crowd, it lowered the status of that crowd. Only they didn't know it. And I hadn't had a drink. I was trying to not drink. I think you got 300,000 years off in purgatory if you didn't drink till you were 21. And I didn't know how bad purgatory was, but I pictured bubbling oil and things like that, so that kept me away from the booze. But the social situations were getting so filled with pressure that I needed relief. It was just unbearable to just be me in the middle of all of this other people. And so at a social event one night where I was supposed to meet all these other guys, I had a drink because I couldn't stand the way they all looked at me with contempt, and they didn't want to know me, and it made me feel so uncomfortable. And I had three drinks. I was halfway through the third drink when I turned around, and I guess those guys, while I was drinking, changed their mind about me, because when I took a second look at them, they all wanted to know me. Their eyes were begging me to come over and join them. Oh, please, please join our group. And I'm looking, and it's like everyone in that room wanted to know me. I could just see it. And then I felt different. I just had a little spring in my step, and I started walking over towards them, and I went, they're right. They would be lucky to know me. And I just went and gave myself to them all night. Just, here I am. And I intuitively knew how to handle situations that were totally baffling. I could make small talk. I had access to my own creativity for the first time in my life when I was in the presence of other people. When I was alone, I could be very creative and write and think and do all that. But as soon as I got with other people, it shut down. So I looked like a dummy. I would just be standing there going, nice day, nice day, ha, nice day, nice day. I should have had like two things, you know, how are the Yankees doing? I mean, you know, then I'd have two things I could say. But other than that, I just, anything I thought of saying, I said, no, I'm not going to say that. They're going to laugh at it. That would be ridiculous to say. Wait, you wouldn't say that. Don't say that. Okay. Nice day. Yeah, it is. And now I could say anything, and it was brilliant. Whatever I was saying, they were, oh, ho, 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 ho. And I went, God, this is great. I should have started drinking in grammar school. This is very important stuff I just came across. I just solved a problem I've had since I've been alive. I've only been drinking 30 minutes. And this is making this big an impression on me. And it went on for an hour when the guys are going, and I'm going, don't leave, wait, I'm not through. And they're all leaving. And so I drank and drank and drank. I figured if three, it's fun. 20 would be amazing. And and at the end of that evening, I had what you always have in your first night of drinking. The room is spinning. I'm vomiting. I'm dying. I'm sleeping by the toilet, and I'm on the cold marble. It felt so good. I learned that's a good place to sleep, right next to the toilet, and you get up and dry heave and just all that. And then I finally got into bed when the sun was coming up, and I was dying like an axe had been put in my head. Just, and I, this is the most pain I've ever felt. Just dying. And the thought occurred to me, are you going to drink again tonight? And the answer was like this: yes. Of course I am. This pain is a small price to pay for what I had last night. That's how important it was, what I had last night. I had access to something that would make the rest of my life very enjoyable. So I had a new deal with alcohol. And if they had come up and said, wait a minute, before you drink any further, we wanted you to sign a contract. We have a drinking contract. We do this with all real drinkers. We want you to understand the fine print before you proceed. Now, would you be willing to give up your high grades for what you had last night? Yeah, I'll sign that. That's fine. Okay. Now, would you give up all athletics? Yes, I'll be glad to give up all athletics. Would you mind getting beat up occasionally and going to jail? No, that'll be all right. Would you mind if your family disowned you? No, that'll be all right. I don't really feel like I'm part of that family anyway. Okay, go ahead and drink. But at least we got the cards all on the table and you understand the deal. If they had told me all that, I would have said, yeah, that'd be fine. Now, I thought I was just a social drinker like the other guys, right? We all look alike. They're getting drunk. They're getting arrested. They're doing that. My roommate and I, we drank a lot together and got in fights and, you know, the same kind of trouble, but he's not an alcoholic. And he went on, became a very successful businessman in Dallas. And many years later, I'm in AA, and he just loved AA because it saved my life. So whenever I went to Dallas, he would come to the convention. And we made him one year back in the 70s, we were making him an honorary member of AA. He was showing up at so many things in Dallas. So we were both about 50 years old, and I asked him one night, Roy, we've started out drinking together, and we look very similar. But now you're 50 years old. If somebody were to ask you, what does alcohol mean to you? You know, what does it mean to you? I want to know what it feels like to be inside your head. And he thought about it a minute, and he said, well, number one, alcohol makes food taste better. And I went, that's number one? Wow. Now, see, no one in here would have come up with that, right? You wouldn't have. And I remember thinking to myself, is that going down or coming up? What is that? And then he said something about, well, he comes home from work and he has a beer and it makes a little transition from the work day to the relaxation. But he never said, oh, alcohol is the absolute secret of life. He never said that. It wasn't very important to him. It was nice, like spaghetti and other things, but it was wasn't anything he'd die for. So even though it looked like the two of us were having the same experience as we went through college, I was having an entirely different experience than he was. And I was to find that out when I joined the Marine Corps and became a fighter pilot. And when I was overseas in Japan, I loved it. I was born to do this. I was so excited by being in this camaraderie and being in this tight-knit little unit. And I just loved the guys, and we drank as a unit. The colonel would all go to happy hour. We had our own table and model plane in the middle, and we ordered rounds of drinks. You didn't order one on your own. They'd get the order for the 20 drinks, and then they'd call the waitress, or 20 more, 20 more, 20 more. And so it looked to me like I was in this heaven with everyone drinking just like me. I mean, it just felt wonderful. I just loved it. And one day I was out in the end of the runway with the maintenance officer, a big redheaded Irish guy. And he was talking about, we were watching our other guys practicing for carrier landings. And he was talking about how he wanted to get promoted to lieutenant colonel and get his own fighter squadron, how great that was going to be. He was just so excited about it. And he was up for it in another year or so. And I was going, yeah, this guy would be great. What a good guy. He said, I'd get nothing but the best pilots in there. And I was going, yeah, yeah, yeah. And then he said, I'd want you in there. And he's pointing to me at first lieutenant. And I'm just going, oh, I have arrived. You know what I mean? This guy is pointing at me. And then he said, but I wouldn't let you drink. And I went, what? What? Where would he come up with that? And I didn't say a word, but it hit me way down in my gut. Like, what is that that this drinking friend of mine would say, but I wouldn't let you drink? You know, after I got in AA and I got thinking about that, in the middle of all this heavy drinking, you know, guys getting drunk every night and chasing around all over the place and flying and just going 100% of the time, mine looked different. I was drinking at a level that was beyond where these guys. He saw something in my drinking that went, whoa, what is that guy doing? The rest of us are just getting drunk. He's doing something else. He's drinking in a different way. There was something about me and my relationship with alcohol that scared him, made him go, whoa, this guy is going to kill himself. That's what he saw. And he was right. He saw exactly what was going on, that I was not in charge of anything. My alcoholism was. And that drinking wasn't just a way to have fun. Drinking was how I got through life. And that meant if you ever took it away from me, we have a serious problem. And as the years went on, the drinking took over more and more and more, and I eventually was having a very hard time flying because you had to not drink for 8 hours, 12 hours, something like that, before you got in the plane. And if you do that, you are entering withdrawal from alcohol. And if you get in the advanced stages, that's a very dangerous situation to be in, to crawl into the plane during withdrawal from alcohol. And I was doing that, and I was losing my peripheral vision. My hands are trembling. I'm sweating. I'm confused. I'm not thinking clearly. And these things, you know, you got to stay with them. They're going fast, and stuff is happening. So I could feel the anxiety of flying in the plane with me. You know, it was like, are you sure you're going to go up with you? And you know, look at you. I'll be all right. Get some oxygen and suck it in. I'll be all right. But I knew I wasn't, and it was getting worse and worse. And so I finally went to a doctor, and they agreed it was awful. You can't fly anymore until we figure out what is causing this. And there was no disease of alcohol and no alcohol programs or anything. So you couldn't be an alcoholic, so they had to find out what it was. And they studied me for a couple of weeks, every kind of doctor. And at the end of that time, they concluded that the trembling hands, the high blood pressure, the eyes all bloodshot, and the clammy sweat, and the confusion, the disorientation, and the constant reeking of alcohol was due to a childhood fear of flying that just showed up after 12 years of flying. And therefore, I should be taken off of flight status and given another specialty since I had a career going. And I was retrained 3 months later as an air traffic controller. And that's what I did the last year that I drank. And I checked into the unit over in Japan, again, back to Japan. And the senior enlisted men saw me, and they just, Captain, oh, welcome aboard. You know, here's your tent and chairs and all that. Sir, we'd appreciate it if you personally never went near the radar and controlled any airplanes. So we'll do that, and you just try to get to work. And that turned out to be a little more than I could handle. As time went on, you know, where is work? So I'd be riding my little bike and going down. And so now I say this, you know, like tongue in cheek, but now the restraints are off on my drinking. I mean, you know, like no more 8 hours prior to flying. And I guess I really did take it to another level because I started getting malnutrition. I stopped hanging out with my buddies. I wouldn't go to happy hour. I just drank alone. We were living in Quonset huts when we weren't deployed. And I just would stay there, and there was I'd get vodka, and I'd mix it with juice. And that was how I was trying to eat, because I couldn't eat regular food. So I thought juice would do it, and I'd mix it. And it just was a nightmare year, and I somehow got through the year and came back to Quantico, Virginia, which is why I got sober in Washington, D.C., because this is where I crashed and burned. And I was down there attending a career school to get promoted, and I was having hallucinations. I mean, it was, I would go to that school. I couldn't find my classroom. I'd get in the classroom. I couldn't find what table I was at. You know, you worked with the same group of guys for like 5 months. Couldn't open the combination to the locker to do athletics. You know, so these guys are going, Sandy, here. And my hands are going like this, and they're all watching this, but no one could do anything. I talked to these guys later, and they said, we knew you were dying, but there wasn't anything we could do. So we just were pretending that we didn't see what we were seeing. And so it was real scary. And I remember coming to work one day, and I drove up to this school complex, which was several large brick buildings, and they were gone. The whole complex was gone. So I went back to the main gate and reported it. Told the sentries at the gate that junior school was gone. That I just went up there, and they said, Captain, what? And I said, it's gone. So the guy got in the car with the red light, and bam, we drove up. It was back, you know. So he came over, he said, what's right there, Captain? I said, yeah, I see it. It's back. So he drove back. I would love to have heard the conversation in the guard shack. But it was in that school that I had a grand mal seizure and just about bit my tongue in half. They put me in the ambulance. I'm in the hospital. I'm there for 5 days while they're studying what could have caused a seizure. And at the end of 5 days without alcohol, then I went in the DTs, and it was so scary, and the CIA was trying to break me with memory tests, and it all spun off of that nut ward thing where you count backwards from 100 by sevens. You know, everybody been locked up? Oh, well. That's the first thing they do, count backward from 100 by 7. You go 93, and that's as far as you can go. Trust me. Okay? I can barely do it now, you know what I mean? But so anyway, they put me in a straitjacket, they locked me up, and I stayed there for 6 months. And during that, near the end of the stay, AA wormed their way in with a meeting. I went to the meeting. I loved it, but I wasn't convinced it was for me. So when I was let out as an outpatient, I started drinking and brought vodka into the nut ward, even though they told me if I ever drank again, my career was over. Paranoia set in. I knew they were watching me. So I called AA on Pearl Harbor Day, 1964. And the guy who was still my sponsor, he's been my sponsor for 40 years, came to my house, another Marine captain, great big guy, huge. And he just came in and said, this is a 12-step call. I talk, you listen. Get in the car. It's just like... And I'm going, I think some of the booze had settled and I didn't need AA anymore, but he was there. And but I couldn't argue with him. It was just off. We're off to the first meeting in Manassas, and it was a group anniversary, and the damn meeting lasted 5 hours with food and ham and turkey and square dancing, and people are ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha. Celebrating anniversaries, and isn't sobriety wonderful? And I'm just going, God. And it was in this dumpy little place that had an outhouse. It didn't even have a flush toilet. Odd Fellows Hall, and it stunk. You had to take a deep breath and then run in, come back out. And it had a space heater hanging from the ceiling to heat the place, and he sat me right in front of it. I always had to sit in the front row. You're sitting in curable row. And I'd sit in front row, and that space heater would go, bong! So I was not happy at this meeting, and people are, oh boy, you want some more turkey? Want some more? No, I don't eat. I can't. It makes me sick to eat. So it's not a pleasant thing. And I was out on the front of this building, and it was rainy December, almost icy. And there was, it was off by itself. There wasn't even street lights. And I was trying to make a break for it. I had no idea which way to go. I mean, it was, I got to get out of here because, you know, there was a guy who had 5 years in there. And I said, why would he be here 5 years? I mean, and I saw that maybe once they get you, you can't get out. And that this is, it's essential. You better get out of here tonight or you may never get out. And I was standing there in all of this panic and all that, and an Al-Anon lady named Betsy Lynch. Her husband and I later became very close friends. He died of cancer, and I was close to him all the way through the thing. But I didn't know her from a hole in the ground. And I felt this hand on my shoulder, and I turned around, and it was her. And she looked at me like an angel, and she just said, it's going to be all right. And there was something about her hand touching me and her voice, and I believed it. I believed it. I just went, oh, come on back in. I went back in, and I just felt, oh, I think I'll stay. It was amazing what that did. And I haven't had a drink since. I went through all this stuff and lost my Marine Corps career. Bill, my sponsor, and I both came up for promotion. You have to make major in order to get your 20 years in. And you get 2 years to try, and we both didn't make it the first year because recovered alcoholics and all that kind of stuff. He had a good job for an alcoholic. He was in explosive ordnance disposal. And he used to kid around and go, it's a perfect job for an alcoholic because nobody's looking over your shoulder while you're working. You know, taking a bomb apart. And then the second year he made it and I didn't. And I had got a little resentment over that. I had 6 kids and no money. And I'm out. You don't get retired. You don't get anything. You just get to leave with an honorable discharge. So I'm out in the streets. And I hadn't prepared well. I didn't have a job. I hadn't really looked. And I'm going, well, I wonder what a washed up pilot, air traffic controller failure can get. Maybe I could sweep the street somewhere. That was how I felt. And so I wasn't getting a job. And we're running out of money. And I'm thinking to myself, I remember that crucifix, and I remember that God, and I know that's the one. The AA is talking about this loving God. I went to a meeting every night for 2 years. I made coffee. I did everything I was asked to do, and what does this loving God do to the 8 people here that are starving to death? You know, you've got to build up your resentment, you know, and make it more, a little more glamorous and dramatic. No one had missed a meal yet. I was sort of making it a little better movie than it was. And so I built this thing up into a federal case. I mean, I had a resentment against God that was just, you know, so I would sit there with all of this and I'd be going, thank you very much, God. I want to thank you. My family wants to thank you. What we love is a loving God. God, and we really thank you. And boy, I can't tell you what it means to us to have you in our lives. And these steps, they certainly work. And AA, look at AA, go to a meeting every night. What do you get? Crapped on. That's what you get. And, of course, I had this resentment is now just consuming me. I don't think about anything about this injustice. Maybe we ought to make a movie about this because I don't think I've ever heard of a bigger injustice than this. You know, did you ever do that? And when they happen to you, they're much bigger than when they happen to other people. And so this is going on in my mind, and I'm not telling anybody because they might get it away from me. You know what I mean? I'm going to keep this baby. This is not, you don't want to give this one up. You're not going to forgive on this one. This is beyond forgiveness limits. There are limits to forgiveness, and this is beyond it. So forget it. And that's the state I'm in when I read a little article in the Washington Post, a little tiny one paragraph thing, and said, Marine Corps instruction team from Quantico, Virginia, my unit, killed in plane crash in Denver. And I went, oh my God, all the guys I work with are dead. The general's dead. If I got promoted, I would have been on that plane with them and I'd be dead. Whoa. And God knows, I just read this article. And I was trying to hide. It's hard to hide from God. I don't know if you've ever tried. So he knew, I knew, and so I mumbled something like, well, if you had told me this was going to happen, I wouldn't have been so upset about getting thrown out. The Marine Corps went, So I think that started me seriously on this spiritual path. And there's a sentence in the big book, The Spiritual Life is Not a Theory, You Have to Live It. Okay, everybody reads that, and I read that, and I said, yeah, you're right. That's right. You got to live it. And I go, well, are you living it? And I don't know. I'm not sure. I don't know what the hell that means, but I don't want to tell my sponsor I don't know what it means. So, yeah, you got to live it, man. You got to live this spiritual program. That's what you have to do. And I'm going, I wonder how you live this spiritual program. What does it mean to live this spiritual program? And so that's when I really got thinking about the steps. You know, we do these steps, and like I said, they don't make sense when you look at them. But you know that the point is to get involved with a higher power. But you're not going to get involved with the one on the crucifix that, you know what I mean, the one that I made up in my head. So what are you going to get involved with? So then you turn to AA and you go, well, tell me about your God. Oh, we don't have one. If there's 400 people here, we got 400 different higher powers. Oh, AA doesn't have a higher power. What am I going to believe in? How do you do this? What is this mystery? And so then they go, well, we're going to give you a few clues. Are you ready? Okay, we're ready. You got my attention. Well, then what would you say you are in your state right now? And I'd say, well, I'm not an atheist. I mean, I don't think I can prove the non-existence of God, so I'm probably in the agnostic category. Good, we have a chapter for you. Oh, good. Well, let me help you through it. Good, well, thank you very much. I figure I'm going to connect here. This is probably the chapter where the agnostic stays sober, and then the spiritual people do the steps. That was what I assumed. Some of us know what's in the chapters without reading them. Are you like that ever? Oh, yeah, that's the one to the agnostics. I know that one. So we get in there, and then here it comes. So if you're an agnostic, let me see if I can help you understand God. Are you ready? Here we go. If when you drink, you have little control over the amount you drink. Everybody. Okay, welcome. You're in. And if when you stop, you can't stay stopped, everybody, you're in, then you are probably an alcoholic of our type, as Clancy was talking about. That's who we are. Is that you? That's you? That's you? Yep. Oh, yeah, that's me. I have little control over the amount. When I stop, I can't stay. Yep, that's me. Okay. You are suffering from an illness that only a spiritual experience can conquer. Let me repeat that. You are suffering from an illness that only a spiritual experience can conquer. Now, how do you feel about that? Are you sure? I know a lot of doctors. I never heard them talking about illnesses that a spiritual experience. It's not in my HMO. There's no thing where they prescribe spiritual experiences. Are you sure? Yes, yes. This is the one disease that only a spiritual experience. And then I looked right at my sponsor and I said, well, Bill, I don't believe in spiritual experiences. He said, well, you're screwed. It's over. And I went, it's over? Yeah. There's no other answer. Wow. Well, what am I supposed to do? Well, maybe you could reconsider your position on spiritual experiences. Oh, you mean like change my mind? Yes, change your mind. How do you do that? I don't know if I've ever actually done that in my life. Change my mind. You mean like say that this is right? No, don't say that. I want you to say you're wrong. Well, isn't it the same thing, Bill? No, it's not. I want you to say you're wrong. It's stuck. I couldn't say it. I don't know if you had that problem. I'm wrong. I can't hear you. I'm wrong. Finally, okay, I'm wrong. Oh, I heard you. You're wrong. Is that what you said? You're wrong? Yeah. Okay, Bill, I'm wrong. You have to tell everybody? We don't have to everybody. Just between you and I, I'm wrong. But I don't want him to know I'm wrong. Jeez. That is the power of self-centeredness, is to never be wrong. We might die. And then I didn't die. I mean, I was wrong. I was fine. So then I was wrong about the fact that I was going to die if I ever admitted I was wrong. So two things I was wrong about. Turns out, freedom into the spiritual world is by finding everything we're wrong about and getting rid of it. And that's what we do for the rest of the time we're in here. What else am I wrong about? There's great freedom in getting rid of wrong things. Hey, another one. You all gone. A little bit of pain while you yank it out, but boom. And that's the beginning of finding out what you're wrong about. And then, you know, but my ego jumps in and goes, wait a minute, I don't want to be wrong all the time. I say, you want to be stuck with those crappy ideas? Yeah, they're mine. They're mine. But they're very frightening. You're nobody. Everybody else is good. You're bad. The world sucks. You want to hold on to that with a death grip? Well, I thought it up. I probably ought to keep it. No! Get free from it. Get rid of old ideas that are wrong. And that was the beginning of this thing. So here I am. I'm in this chapter of the agnostic, and now he's gotten me going, okay, I'll reconsider the spiritual thing, the spiritual. Okay, well, here it is. Now you're at a crossroads. You're going to have to make a big decision. This is your life or death decision, so come on up on the stage. We need some witnesses because we want this to be embedded in your life for the rest of your life. Are you ready? Are you ready? This is your junk. This is it. You know, back in the old days in the Oxford group, that you'd go to the meeting and you'd stay there for about 15 minutes. And the husbands and wives would be there all together and they'd read a few spiritual things. And then two or three guys would take you and you'd go upstairs. And they'd go, are you ready? And you'd go, what? And then they just look you right in the eye and they just go, do you believe in God? Yeah. Yes? Well? Okay. Get on your knees. We're going to pray. That's a big deal. Big deal. We're more subtle. But it's almost the same thing. Come on up. You have to pick a door, son. We got two of them behind here. I'm going to open the curtain. Are you ready? Here's door number one, die an alcoholic death. Door number two, live on a spiritual basis. What's it going to be? And if you like the rest of us, you go like this. Oh, boy. Whoa. Is this one of those programs where you get to make one call? Yes. Okay. Hello, doctor? Yes. A friend of mine is curious, how bad is an alcoholic death? Oh. Okay. Spiritual basis. So you can see, we got spiritual by default. Holding our nose with great suspicion, we chose the spiritual door because there was nowhere else to go. So what did we admit at this moment? This is why it's so important. This is step one and two. We said, I understand that my situation requires a higher power, or it's over. So AA never tries to prove the existence of God, but we're specialists in proving the need for God. And once you admit that you need, whatever definition you want to fill in, creator of the universe, great spirit, doesn't matter. The second you say, I desperately need something beyond myself, or it's over, you're 99% home. Isn't that exciting? Then we have these other little steps that we just get through. But that one takes you 99% of the way. Because if you do that, you're not debating the rest of them. There's no debate over any of them. You just go, I'm in. I'm in for the whole deal. Sign me up. It's like joining the Marine Corps or something, man. You've been through boot camp. You're in. And so that is the essence of this spiritual debate that's been going on in your head, is to finally give up. And take out a handkerchief and just go, I surrender unconditionally. What should I do next? And that's the only question you ever have to ask for the rest of your life. What should I do next? And in the beginning, you ask this question of your sponsor and your home group. But as time goes on, you ask it of your higher power. What should I do next? What should I do next? And that's the essence of turning our life over. And then we find out that we can make a decision to turn our life over, but it doesn't happen. Wonder why? We have character defects that do not like the idea of turning our life over to the care of God. They just don't like it. Sounds good, but we ain't going to do it. And we can't get it done on our own. So we have to work on removing the blockages, which are the character defects. There's blockages. In other words, this power, it was born inside of us. All we have to do is have access to it. The 12 steps are tools. They're spiritual tools, but they're power tools. They have to be plugged in. You can't just do them yourself. Okay, I'm going to be loving and generous. I'm going to be all this. You can't rise above yourself by yourself. You have to be plugged into something that is bigger than you, and then you can be lifted above yourself. And that's the point of doing the middle steps, to get these blockages out of the way. We inventory, and then we talk them over with somebody else. And then we struggle with our ego to get the humility and the willingness to have these removed. And that's one of the great mysteries. We don't have time to talk about it today, is why in God's name do we fight so hard about having these character defects removed? And very briefly, Bill suggests is that we enjoy them too much. And we don't want them removed. We want them moderated. That's what we want. Would you like to give up gossiping? It's a terrible thing. Dr. Bob said it's killing AA. Would you like to get rid of gossiping? Of course I would. I'd love to get rid of most gossip. I certainly would. As a matter of fact, I'm never going to originate gossip again. Never, never am I going to start a mean story. However, if someone else starts it, and I'm simply relaying the gossip myself, I am simply a messenger here as opposed to an evil creator of gossip. So I'm going to make a big improvement in gossip. Fine, fine. So we're not willing to get rid of gossip. Okay, how about lust? Would you like to get rid of lust? Lust is sex, you know, just all these things that really impinges on being spiritual. Wouldn't you love to get rid of that? Yes, I would love to. Are you talking about total get ready? Like, you're saying zero lust would be left. Is that what you're saying? Yes, we're going to get rid of total lust. Well, what I'd like to do, we're not into celibacy in our family. So what I'd like to do is, I'd like to get it down where nobody notices what I'm up to. That's what I'd like to do. What about honesty? Wouldn't you like to be honest? Honesty, honesty, open-mindedness, willingness. Honesty is it, right? Wouldn't you like to be honest? Honest, honest. God could just come in and just, everything you say would be the truth. You'd speak honestly all the time. You'd go, you know, that would be so freeing. I'd love that. But you see, I'm in the business world. And I don't think you can get ahead. in the business world and be totally honest. I mean, what I'd like to do is be honest most of the time and just reserve the right to screw a guy every so often to make sure my business doesn't go out of business. So what I'd like to be, I'd like to have a reputation for being honest. That's what I'd like to have, is a reputation for being honest. So you can see the struggle we have with all the other character defects than drinking. Drinking was killing us, so we could get entirely willing to get rid of that. So then it moves us, and this is where I want to just finish with five more minutes or so. We work through all this stuff and do the best we can in opening up this channel so we're sensing this. And we're carrying around a lot of garbage from the past, and so we do steps 8 and 9. And there's a tremendous freedom as we do those. And we're lifted into what I call a spiritual awakening. And, you know, you wonder, what is a spiritual awakening? You go back and you look under the definition of spiritual awakening in the appendix. It doesn't really help very much. It simply explains that in the early book, we said that it was a big boom. And now we've come to find out, well, most people, it happens gradually. What happens gradually? What happens gradually? What is it? You know, well, in the 12 and 12, in the 12th step, it says you are able to do, feel, and experience things that you weren't able to do on your own before. That's semi-helpful. Do you know we read about a spiritual experience almost every meeting in Tampa? We read all about it, and nobody knows that we're reading about it. We read, we're going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We're not going to regret the past, nor wish to shut the door on it. Fear of economic insecurity, fear of people of economic insecurity will leave us. Leave us? What kind of a verb is that? I've had this fear of people and economic insecurity all my life. It's just part of me. And I was standing there one day and it said, let's get out of here. And it was gone. I didn't really do anything. I looked around, it was gone. And oh boy, you talk about a self-seeker. I've been a self-seeker all my life. Me. I was standing there being self-seeking, and all of a sudden, it slipped away. It sounds like 50 ways to leave your lover. It slipped out the back, Jack. What kind of verbs are these? Would you ever go to a psychiatrist and go, could you get self-seeking to slip away while we're sitting here in therapy? He'd go, slip away. No, we're going to overcome it. You're going to be, you know. These are spiritual verbs. The entire set of promises is a spiritual awakening. That's the entire set. And right after the promises, as we come into the maintenance steps, into the 10th step, there's an interesting line. Bill writes, we are entering the world of the spirit. Now, we're going to live life on a spiritual basis. This got us ready to live life on a spiritual basis. Now we're going to live it on a spiritual basis. We're going to maintain the promises in our lives. What does it say immediately after that? Alcohol is a subtle foe. We have not been cured of alcoholism. We've been given a daily reprieve contingent on our spiritual condition. So as long as we maintain the spiritual condition, the promises stay there. They just stay there. They're part of your life. And those promises, if we really laid them out on a blackboard and you had never read the big book, and I put those things up here, and then I said to you, do you think those are extravagant? You wouldn't say, we think not. You'd go, you're damn right! Those things are extravagant that could happen in your life. And there they are. That's what spirituality is. Now, the problem is we can't take credit for that. That's all coming by walking hand in hand with our higher power. And part of us doesn't like the image of walking hand in hand with anything because you look like a little boy. Hi, I'm walking through life. Isn't it? Look at me. And they're going, hey, pal, when are you going to get on your own? When are you going to grow up and be a man? When are you going to hold on all day? Hey. If AA, let me give you this analogy. What if we said, you want us to have a happy life forever? We're going to give you an AA bicycle. and we're going to illumine the spiritual path in front of you. All you do is get on the bike and ride down that path, and you will have the perfect life. You like that? Great. You get on the bike, and you notice there are training wheels on it. You don't ask any questions. You just get on and you go, and you do it, and everything's wonderful, but it's bugging you that there's training wheels on there. You know what I'm saying? You're going, I really like this, all except the training wheel part. I've been riding this for 3 years. I've never lost my balance and had those training wheels hit. So you go to your sponsor, when do the training wheels come off? He said, they don't come off. That's part of the deal. After a while, the training wheels are ruining the whole deal. They're ruining your own happiness. I love it out here. Everything's perfect except for the training wheels. It's bugging me that they're there. That's how much our ego and self-centeredness does not like help. No matter how far we progress spiritually, Bill writes in the 12 and 12, no matter how far we've gone, desires will always be there to oppose the grace of God. But there's this insane desire to somehow get free from this higher power, do it on our own. And the struggle we have as we continue in our sobriety is to get closer and closer to being in a state of constantly receiving help. Constantly receiving help. And so that's why when we talked about the making the resolutions, we forget to leave God out of it. So maybe this year our resolutions can always include the word God. And whatever you set as a goal, we just go, my goal is to have God help me, and then you fill in the blanks. And I have a hunch it's going to be one of our best years. It's been an honor to be here with you all. And if you're new, God bless you. You are in for the treat of your life, and thank you all very much.